Today, on this episode of the PureDirect Special Spotlight.
Right now, in non-small cell lung cancer, the two important biomarkers are both mutation status by NGS and overexpression status measured by IHC. So both are important biomarkers now to be testing. They both carry different implications for what we'll be doing next.
Today, Drs. Cooper and Roto join the podcast to discuss first-line strategies in HER2-positive lung cancer in this PureDirect Special Spotlight. All opinions expressed are those of the presenters and do not necessarily reflect the views of this educational initiative's supporters.
Hello, I'm Alyssa Cooper. I'm a medical oncologist at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute here in Boston, Massachusetts.
And I'm Dr. Julia Roto. I am also a medical oncologist and the clinical director of the Lowe Center for Thoracic Oncology at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, also an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School.
Thanks for joining us. Today, we're going to discuss the first-line treatment of HER2-positive non-small cell lung cancer. We'll explore how to approach therapy selection, the evolving role of antibody-drug conjugates and TKIs, and how sequencing strategies are beginning to take shape in clinical practice. How's that sound to you, Julia?
That sounds great, Alyssa.
Julia, when you're first evaluating a patient with newly diagnosed HER2-positive non-small cell lung cancer, what's your approach to testing? NGS is clearly the backbone, but do you see any role for IHC or FISH in clarifying amplification or overexpression versus mutation?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's a really important point because there are many different ways to read or to measure aberration in HER2 behavior in non-small cell lung cancer. And we can look for HER2 mutations, which we usually find via NGS-based testing. We can look for HER2 amplification, which you might find on NGS. But also via things like FISH, that's less commonly used in the non-small cell lung cancer setting, and that's excessive copies of the gene. Or you can look for HER2 overexpression via IHC, and that's too much protein expression on the cell surface. Right now, in non-small cell lung cancer, the two important biomarkers are both mutation status by NGS and overexpression status measured by IHC. So both are important biomarkers now to be testing. They both carry different implications for what we'll be doing next in terms of potential therapeutic options, either in the initial line setting or more commonly in the later line setting right now, according to current drug approvals and standard of care.
I think that's a really important point. And I think it's important for our audience also to be aware of the fact that efficacy of certain drugs, like, for example, trastuzumab deruxtecan, is more efficacious in the HER2 mutation setting versus in the HER2 overexpression setting. So it is important to clarify the difference between different disease statuses when you're treating a patient.
Yeah, I agree. There's also different patient populations. We think about who we classically find with HER2 mutations in non-small cell lung cancer. Most commonly, we think of younger non-smoking patient populations. So just like all of our other actionable oncogene targets, we do find these across all demographic breakdowns, including patients who are older, patients who are male, and patients with history of tobacco use. HER2 IHC overexpression is a little less strongly associated with, say, tobacco use history or not, but still can be found across the board, so to speak, in non-small cell lung cancer as an adenocarcinoma. So important to be offering both these tests to our patients. So, Alyssa, we're starting to see some momentum around bringing HER2-targeted therapies into the frontline setting. How close do you think we are to shifting beyond chemoimmunotherapy as the default for these patients?
It's a really excellent question, and I think we're much closer now than we were potentially a couple of years ago. We do have lots of exciting therapies that are targeted to the HER2 mutation setting and overexpression setting. Trastuzumab deruxtecan was the first to be really exciting in this patient population. It's an antibody-drug conjugate, but most recently, tyrosine kinase inhibitors such as zongertinib and savobertinib have been presented and have shown really exciting efficacy in the later line setting. What we're awaiting now is clinical trials which pose these therapies against the first-line standard of care, and these are all ongoing and enrolling, and I think that will make clear, when these trials read out, what our first-line choice should be for treatment for these patients.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's very tempting. I think it's great to have patients have access to these agents, for example, through clinical trial scenarios. I think we've also often been thinking about using these things off-label, potentially in the frontline setting. I will emphasize that right now the standard of care first line for HER2 mutant lung cancer remains a chemotherapy-based therapies, either that platinum doublet or platinum doublet plus immunotherapy-based strategies. So one of the big questions in practice is sequencing. If a patient starts with chemo, what do you prefer next? And conversely, if we move targeted therapy earlier, how do we think about what comes after?
It's a really excellent question. And I think part of the considerations we give to that question are to efficacy, and the other considerations we give to that question are toxicity. Thinking about efficacy as its own question, we do see, for example, that in the trial of zongertinib, this drug was more efficacious when used prior to an ADC such as trastuzumab deruxtecan versus when trastuzumab deruxtecan was used before this TKI. So that is something we certainly would keep take into account when treating our patients. The other thing we would want to think about would be toxicity. We do think about the proximity of checkpoint inhibitors such as pembrolizumab in proximity to ADC such as trastuzumab deruxtecan, which does have an ILD or pneumonitis risk. And so we do need to think about, are those therapies close in time? Is one close to before the other? And so we would often think about that when choosing a therapy for patients in that setting.
Yeah, I agree. And this is really new for us in non-small cell lung cancer. We have more and more active therapeutic options. It's coming up not just in HER2 mutant lung cancer, but in other settings as well, where we have, you know, not just sequencing, say, TKIs, which we're used to doing in practice, but now we're sequencing ADCs with ADCs, ADCs with TKIs, or bispecifics with the other two classes of therapies. And I think we still have a lot to learn about what does that mean when you develop resistance to one class of treatment, what will happen next in terms of activity on the next line of therapy. Some of this will from our clinical trial data, where we have sequenced patients available within these prospective trial databases. And some I think we're going to learn as part of our real-world practice and as part of real-world evidence as these multiple different classes of therapies really reach patients more broadly in the clinic.
Yeah, just to piggyback on that excellent point, I think, you know, one thing we definitely need to learn from our patients enrolled in clinical trials is whether there's any change in the target. Once we utilize a targeted therapy such as a TKI, might there be downregulation of expression? Might make a later targeted therapy less efficacious? Might there be resistance mechanisms that are acquired? We know some of these paradigms and strategies based on our other oncogene-driven cancers, but this is all very relatively new in HER2 mutant lung cancer. Julia, when you look specifically at ADCs versus TKIs in HER2-positive lung cancer, what do you see as the strengths and limitations of each in the first line and beyond?
Yes, we have two very different classes of therapy right now available in HER2 mutant lung cancer. This is great news for our patients. We want more therapies, and ideally more therapies which are not cross-resistant. But these are very different, both in terms of their efficacy profile, their side effect profile, and also in terms of patients' day-to-day experience on therapy. We had T-DXd, which is approved first for previously treated HER2-positive non-small cell lung cancer. And this is an infusional agent. It's an antibody-drug conjugate. So it comes with some of the cytotoxic toxicities we've come to expect from antibody-drug conjugates, like cytopenias or fatigue, and of course, regular IV infusions. But it also comes with efficacy with response rates in the mid-50% and median progression-free survival around or just over 8 months. So certainly clinically active for this patient population. Now, on the other hand, HER2 TKIs, and here I'll focus on zongertinib as the agent with FDA approval, so it's available at this time, is an oral targeted therapy. So it's an oral agent, no infusions for patients to be undertaking, which is nice. It does have, I think, fairly impressive efficacy data, which has come out in the initial clinical trials in the previously treated setting. Here, response rates reaching closer to 70%, median progression-free survival, I believe, reaching closer to a year or just past a year, and a little different toxicity profiles as well, with some GI toxicities and LFT abnormalities that have been seen on treatment. So these are different experiences for patients. I think both hopefully are going to be a part of most of our patients' therapy as we go forward, sequence one after the other. I think the jury is still out what the best order of operations, so to speak, will be. So we have some choices to make now when we're talking about these agents with our patients in practice. And not all HER2-positive patients are the same. Are there particular clinical or molecular features that might push you towards one strategy of the over when you're making a choice, maybe in the frontline setting, but also in that later line setting as we're employing these therapies?
Yeah, these are all such excellent patients as you're, you know, making a clinical decision for the patient sitting in front of you. What is going to be best for that patient in this setting based on both their clinical and demographic and molecular characteristics? This is the million-dollar question that we all wish we could answer with 100% accuracy as a physician. I think a couple of things that I've been thinking about this question, you know, the efficacy of zongertinib is really just compelling. And I do think that most patients will deserve a shot at that, certainly in the later line, but potentially in the front line as well, once those trials continue to accrue and enroll and read out. I do think about a couple of high-risk features that make me wonder if a patient might need step-up therapy or escalated therapy. For example, if a patient has multiple co-mutations or potentially unusual histology like pleomorphic carcinoma, you know, this is not based on any data. This is just sort of based on a gestalt that potentially targeted therapy might be less efficacious for that patient population, and maybe they might benefit for something, for example, like the addition of chemotherapy or other, as we've seen sort of in other oncogene-driven cancers. For example, the FLAURA2 trial, which was just presented at World Lung, did show that patients with EGFR mutant lung cancer did benefit from the addition of chemotherapy in that setting. So I do wonder about something like that in the future that we'll find for these HER2 mutant patient population. I also wonder for the rare patient with HER2 mutations who does have a heavy smoking history, whether those patients might benefit more from the addition of immunotherapy with checkpoint inhibitors. We know that smoking history can be predictive of response to immunotherapy and efficacy. So that's something to consider as well. But, you know, unfortunately, we don't have all of the answers clearly laid out here at this point in time.
Yeah, I do agree. I think, you know, for many of our patients, I agree the efficacy of a HER2 TKI is impressive. And with the convenience of oral therapy, I suspect we're going to be using this frequently our patients either after chemo immunotherapy or even in the frontline setting off-label. I think many patients might elect for that if insurance coverage is able to be obtained. Now, there are subsets of HER2 mutant lung cancer that might behave differently, and we might have less data. I'm thinking about patients with uncommon, sort of non-tyrosine kinase domain HER2 mutations, those with CNS involvement, where I think we're still learning with both classes of therapies what to expect in terms of efficacy profiles. They're much smaller cohorts in the clinical trials. And of course, for untreated CNS disease, it's still very much, I think, a learning area for all of us, though I think both agents have also demonstrated some activity in small cohorts within their respective studies.
One of the current controversies in clinical practice is whether to add in frontline checkpoint inhibitors for patients with HER2 mutations. What's your take on that, and whether you recommend chemotherapy alone or chemoimmunotherapy in this patient population?
Yeah, that's a great question. And right now, it's a real area of uncertainty in clinical practice. For most lung adenocarcinoma at new diagnosis, we're often reaching for chemoimmunotherapy or even immunotherapy alone. But HER2 mutations tend to strike younger non-smoking patient populations. We often group them more with disease categories like EGFR mutant lung cancer, where you worry about the efficacy of checkpoint inhibitor immunotherapy. And indeed, several retrospective studies have suggested that outcomes to checkpoint inhibitor therapies are poor for this patient population. You know, based on this, I certainly do not offer checkpoint inhibitor monotherapy to my patients with this mutation in the frontline setting. And then there's practice variation. Some clinicians like to offer platinum doublet chemotherapy with or without bevacizumab, for example, kind of going back in time to the days pre-immunotherapy, trying to augment platinum doublet activity. And others like to offer standard chemoimmunotherapy, something like platinum pemetrexed, pembrolizumab, or similar, for example. I will say my own practice, I often do include the immunotherapy just as a chance to offer it to patients, though my expectation of efficacy is not as good as it is for the broader patient population. But there is quite a bit of variation, and a platinum doublet with or without VEGF inhibitor is also a very reasonable treatment strategy here. Again, patient history, uncommon mutations, heavy tobacco use history, high PD-L1 might help tip you a little bit one way or the other. But my key piece here is that I wouldn't offer an immunotherapy alone for these patients in the frontline setting.
Thanks for your thoughts on that. I do think if you'd poll 10 medical oncologists across the country, you'd probably get 50-50 either way. Thanks for joining me today, Julia. This has been great. And thank you for joining us for our discussion on first-line strategies in HER2-positive lung cancer.
And that's today's Specialist Spotlight. Thank you for joining us for this episode of PureDirect Medical News Podcast. For more stories like these, visit us at PureDirect.com. Thoughts, comments, or suggestions, please leave us a review on your preferred listening platform or email us at editorial@puredirect.com. Subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Pandora, Apple Podcasts, or TuneIn. You can also download our Amazon Alexa Flash Briefing Medical News Roundup and just ask, "What's my Flash Briefing?" Thanks today to our guests, Drs. Cooper and Roto. Join me next time for an episode where we cover the latest stories in the world of medicine.